And welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me all the way is the youngest, most innocent person I know, Chris Haig.
Hi, I really thought you were going to be like, the youngest, most innocent person, Tom, and I'd have been just like, what? Really?
Okay. I'll give Chris the young part. I'm not so sure on the innocent. But.
That is very close to the truth. How dare you?
Young and not so innocent.
The sequel.
The sequel.
Yeah.
Yes. Awesome. How you doing, Chris?
I am good. How are you? How are things on the other side of the Atlantic?
I'm fantastic. I am having a really good day, and I'm looking forward to... you know, our discussion on this movie today, because I've been so darn busy. I just watched it this morning with Aubrey. I just watched Young and Innocent this morning with her. So I'm looking forward to talking about it. But we can't do it alone, can we, Chris?
Of course we can.
Definitely can't do it alone. You know what we need?
Well, if I'm the young, we need an innocent.
You need an innocent? I was going to say our ever-constant police officer, Tom Caldwell.
I was about to say... Saskatchewan is having quite a beautiful, warm spring day. Almost nice enough weather to take a friend to the beach and shove her off a cliff. But we'll get into that later.
Awesome. Now, Tom, before we hit record, you told us that your nephew told you a Hitchcock joke.
Okay, so I'm visiting family, and I went up before the show to the kitchen, and my nephew Nick, shout out to Nick Caldwell for adding some... brilliant content to the show. Now, I believe his joke went, Hitchcock was working in his office one day and his manager phoned, and Hitchcock said, "Manager, you're doing such a great job. I'd like to reward you with a gift. So I'm sending you a truck and an Airstream trailer. And I hope you enjoy that as a thank you for all your hard work." So a week later, the manager phones Hitchcock back and says, "Where's my trailer hitch?" I didn't write it. You know, don't shoot the piano player. I'm just repeating the joke. So, thank you. Thank you, Nick, for your contribution to the show.
Tell Nick that it was a groan-worthy joke.
Yes, I'm sure. See, there's one more listener. He has to listen to the show now to hear his joke. So, We get our listeners one
joke at a time.
Hooker by crook, one at a time.
Awesome. Well, we are not here to talk about trailer hitches or Truffaut or tell jokes, although maybe we could do that. Maybe we could do a special episode where it's just nothing but Hitchcock jokes. Maybe do that for a Christmas special this year. Today we're talking about Young and Innocent, which is the 1937 British film by Hitchcock. Tom, did you want to start with the summary, or should we start with the history?
No, I'll do the quick summary. And true to our tradition of doing no research whatsoever ahead of taping, I have a summary here from courtesy of Brentwood Home Video from a VHS cover. a DVD cover. It's not that. Well, it's an old movie, but
not just any movie cover, too. The 10 movies in one collection cover.
Yeah. This is a big... a big case
the
full of
the public
CDs
domain
here.
Special.
Yeah. So the film is not rated, and there's a warning for mild violence. A film actress is murdered by her estranged husband, who is jealous of all her young boyfriends. The next day, writer Robert Tisdall, who happens to be one of the boyfriends, discovers her body on the beach. So Robert is arrested, but owing to a mix-up at the courthouse, he escapes and goes on the run with a police constable's daughter, who is Erica, determined to prove his own innocence.
Awesome. Well, this movie came out in 1937. Wikipedia has a release date of November 37 in London and February 17th of 1938 in the USA. Now, with a 1937 release date, it's actually kind of interesting because this is based on a 1936 novel, A Shilling for Candles by Josephine Tay. That's a pretty rapid turnaround from book to film. You know, you think they're going pretty quick with Stephen King these days, but that's pretty quick way back in the day. So significant changes were made in adapting the book for the film. The novel is a whodunit centered on the Scotland Yard inspector, who is Tay's regular character of Alan Grant. The storyline involving Robert Tisdall, Erica Burgoyne, and the missing coat is similar to the film in the story, but in the novel, it's only a subplot and ends partway through the book when Erica finds the coat and it is intact. Grant then focuses on other suspects, none of whom, including the actual murderer in the novel, appear in the film. Christine Clay in the novel is not divorced, but is an unconventional marriage. But is in an unconventional marriage to an aristocrat. Now, I couldn't find anything on the making of the film. Again, all the websites were pretty sparse when it came to this film. So the only behind the scenes aspect I have is the Hitchcock cameo is when Hitchcock's taking a photograph outside the courtroom when the main character escapes. Did you guys see him?
Yeah, I think I did. So. That was a big crowd.
Yeah,
though,
he was right there, front and center in the screen. He's like right there. So I was watching with Aubrey, and I'm like, look, that's the guy. She's like, that's him. So I will just talk a little bit about the actors in the film. Now, Nova Marjorie Pilbeam was an English film and stage actress. She played leading roles in two Hitchcock movies of the 30s, and she made her last film in 1948. Pilbeam was born in Wimbledon, London. Her parents were Arnold Pilbeam, an actor and theater manager, and Marjorie Stouffer Pilbeam. Time magazine reported that the actress, whose first name was an homage to her maternal grandmother from Nova Scotia, opted to keep her birth name, which she considered far less ridiculous than Myrna Loy or Greta Garbo. Pilbeam gained attention as a child stage actress. This led to much work in her teen years, and she was also in The Man Who Knew Too Much, in which she plays a little girl abducted by Peter Lorre's character. Following this with her lead performances in as Lady Jane Grey in Tudor Rose in 1936, she starred in Young and Innocent, which she regarded as the sunniest film I was ever involved with, and formed a constructive professional relationship with Hitchcock. She appeared in an early British television drama in 1939. That year, David O. Selznick wanted Pilbeam for the lead in Hitchcock's Rebecca, and though she could be an international film star, and thought she could be an international film star. However, her agent was worried about the length of a 5-year contract. Meanwhile, Hitchcock, whose outlook on the film was not the same as Selznick's, auditioned hundreds of others over many months, at last giving the role to Joan Fontaine. Unlike some of her peers, Pilbeam never made a film in Hollywood. She continued acting with appearances in at least 9 British films, along with many stage roles throughout the 40s. One of her last films was The Three Weird Sisters from 1948. Its post-war gothic drama screenplay credited to 5 writers, among them Dylan Thomas. She remained working on stage for a short while longer, appearing in the Duchess Theatre in Tony Block's play Flowers for the Living in February of 1950. And again, she was only in 2 Hitchcock films, this one and The Man Who Knew Too Much. Derek Raoul Edward Alfred de Marny was an English stage and film actor and producer of French and Irish ancestry. He was the son of Violet Eileen Concannon and Arthur de Marny, and the grandson of noted Victorian lithographer Alfred Concannon. He appeared on the London stage from 1922 and films from 1928. It was his performance in the lead role of the play Young Mr. Disraeli at the Kingsway and Piccadilly Theatres that brought him the offer of a long-term film contract from Alexander Korda. He is perhaps best remembered for his starring role as Robert Tisdall, falsely accused of murder in Young and Innocent. Other early film roles include Benjamin Disraeli, this time in Victoria the Great from 1937 and its sequel 60 Glorious Years from 1938. After Young and Innocent, he alternated between leading roles and supporting parts in films. He was cast in the title role of Uncle Silas in 1947, a character part in which he played a man formerly suspected of murder who plots against his young niece, an heiress played by Jean Simmons. After a couple more leads in self-produced films, he tended to concentrate on the theater, only taking small roles in film and television thereafter. His last role was in the horror film The Projected Man from 1966. Although he had a home in Kensington in London, de Marny DeMarnie was taken ill while staying with friends in Farnham in Surrey. He died of bronchopneumonia and asthma at the nearby Frimley Park Hospital on the 18th of February, 78. This was his only Hitchcock appearance. Percy Marmot was an English film actor. Marmot appeared in more than 80 films between 1916 and 68. A veteran film actor by 1923, he scored a big hit that year in If Winter Comes. That was a Game of Thrones prequel. Later remade by... I'm just kidding. No laugh. Not even a funny.
Ha ha.
Later remade by...
I take everything... I believe everything you say. I give you absolute knowledge, so...
Later remade by MGM in 1947 as If Winter Comes, which is odd because it's the same title. He is best remembered today for playing the title character in Lord Jim, 1925, the first film version of Joseph Conrad's novel, and for playing one of Clara Bow's love interests in the Paramount Pictures film Mantrap from 1926. He was born and died in London, England. Marmot had two daughters with his wife Dorothy, Patricia Marmot, and actress... then theatrical agent, at one time married to actor Nigel Green, and Pamela, born in 1923, a stage actress married to actor Moray Watson. We saw him in Secret Agent and Richard Strange, and this is his last Hitchcock appearance. And finally, Edward Rigby was a British actor. Rigby was the second son of Jamaican-born Dr. William Harriet Coke and his wife, Liverpool-born Mary Elizabeth, of 17 High Street, Ashford, Kent. He was educated at the Haileybury and the Wye Agricultural College under his real name, Edward Coke. Rigby was his mother's maiden name. He served in the Artists' Rifles and Royal Field Artillery in World War I and was awarded the Military Cross, cited on 17th of September, 1917, for conspicuous gallantry and devotion to duty as artillery liaison officer. At a time when all communication with his artillery group was severed, he made repeated attempts to restore the connection and personally crossed a river under heavy fire in his efforts to mend the cable and to lay fresh ones. He showed the greatest gallantry and disregard of danger throughout the operation and only desisted from his efforts on receiving the direct order from his headquarters to do so. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. And that's all I've got for you guys.
Fair enough.
Right on.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
information.
Funny.
Well, I got to say something funny. As I was watching this movie with Aubrey, she hasn't seen a lot of Hitchcock films, and it was really funny because right at the beginning, when they were going to arrest the guy, Aubrey's like, but he didn't do it.
that's children. Adorable.
So I had to pause it.
Now, how popular would she have been in a movie theater yelling that out in the crowd?
It's fun to watch that with her because, yeah, I had to explain to her that the one common theme in Hitchcock's films is the innocent man on the run. And then I let her know that the same thing happened because we watched North by Northwest a couple of months ago and I said, you know, the same thing was in that movie. So, but the innocent youth, eh? But he didn't do it. Why are they? He didn't do it. We saw that he didn't do it.
Otherwise, it would be a 5-minute film. Okay, we caught the guy. Go home. Yeah.
Excellent. Chris, let's start with your initial thoughts on the film.
So,
Young and Innocent.
Young and Innocent. So I saw this a few years ago because it was part of a DVD collection. So I think I've already told this story in the Man Who Knew So Much episode, but I bought this 3-DVD collection thing. It was 3 films on one disc because it had the 34 Man Who Knew Too Much. And also had Young and Innocent and a Hitchcock film called The Woman in Green. And I liked all of them, but I'd never heard of Young and Innocent. And then I watched it, and I had so much fun. I love this film. It's great. It's such a solid, fun thriller that it definitely has its issues and everything. But when I was going through it, I was like, oh, wow, here's actually a group of characters who I actually really like. You know, and it has a really interesting setup because it's almost initially as though it's gonna it's gonna be a twist, because from the off you think, oh, okay, so obviously, you know, Christine has been killed. She had an argument with her ex-husband Guy, and it just because you never show Guy killing Christine, he kind of just angrily looks at the door and that's it, and then it cuts to morning or fades to morning, and then all of a sudden it's then when Robert walks along and sees Christine and he recognises her and he, you know, goes for help, and that's when all the shenanigans start. So I was just thoroughly entertained with it, and you can kind of see how it does continue a lot of the themes. Or in fact, you know, again, this is a really pure distillation of one of Hitchcock's big recurring story elements or motifs, which is the, you know, the man wrongfully accused of, you know, murder. I mean, we've seen it already in, I can't remember which film it was. We've done it fairly recently. It might have 39 been...
Steps.
Yes, that was it. I feel bad I couldn't remember 39 Steps, but yeah. We've seen it in 39 Steps. But in here, you do get this kind of great, you know, back and forth. And to be honest, it wasn't until you were just talking about it that I remembered that Nova Pilbeam is indeed the daughter in Man I Knew Too Much. I wonder if it was like a Nova Pilbeam, like, disc then. You know, her character of Erica is... I really enjoyed Erica. I think she's great. I think she, you know, is really kind of feisty and interesting and intelligent, and she kind of, you know, she does give as good as she gets, even when she's sort of kidnapped, and then she kind of like, well, okay, we'll talk about that sort of thing. You know, I didn't know the thing about which I don't think actually works, so I might be wrong, but where you pull the ears of a boxer to wake them up. You know, if they've been stunned, you know, she
oh yeah, yeah,
to,
yeah,
to wake him up, she pulls the ears, and I think it's just to cause a pain response or something. But I just think it's great. There are definite issues I have looking on it now, particularly with the last sequence, which is a gorgeous tracking shot that we'll get into. And it is one of the best, most Hitchcockian technical shots we've seen, and we will see. But the issue is just, it's. I mean, I'm sure you guys will agree, it's the blackface.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, we can jump right into that if you want.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, like, I myself didn't have that big of a problem, like, with the blackface in the scene, because it was something that was done at the time, right? At the time that the movie takes place, and they don't make anything out of it. Like, they're just, we talked about it when we did, what the heck was that collage of films?
Elstree Calling,
thank you. When we did Elstree Calling, we're like, I don't understand why it was a thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, it was a thing, and I don't know. We tried looking it up, and it doesn't make any sense to me, like, why they would do that. It's not like, this here's a jazz band. I don't know, like, it's not like black people or jazz people, like, only jazz people or something like that. So, I don't understand why it was a thing, but it was a thing.
Yeah.
And they didn't make much out of it. It was a way to hide the guy in plain sight with something that was done at the time.
Yeah.
You know? No. I was worried going into the film because I didn't remember. I just remembered that it was in here. But watching it this time, to me, I didn't have a problem with it because it was something of the time.
Yeah. Oh, so. Yeah, in terms of the historical context and everything, it makes sense because in, you know, the UK, there was, up until, like, the 60s, 70s, there was this big tradition of minstrel shows. That's what it is. It's a minstrel show where white performers put on blackface, they put on exaggerated... black characteristics, which is, you know, they have, you know, the impossibly big lips and the eyes and all that sort of thing, and they do it deliberately to mock black performers and put it on as a costume. And I understand, I think the thing, I didn't mind it as much in this, only because it was, and this is going to sound like such a weird reason, but it's because it was the villain. If it had been the hero doing it, if it had been like our hero, you know, Robert was trying to hide or anything, and he thought, oh, I'm going to put blackface on to hide everything, I think that would have really hurt me more. Because Hitchcock, you know, so many of his films don't have a lot of racial diversity in them. You know, ironically, we've just finished chatting to Minish about an episode, or doing an episode chatting to Minish about his recent project, and he brought up Lifeboat, which does happen to have a couple of black actors in it. In fantastic roles. And so, yeah, it was one of those things where it's like, I understand the context of the time and everything, but it still sort of makes it a bit uncomfortable. It's a bit like looking back to, like, the 60s and 70s when, you know, in the UK, you know... have you guys ever heard of the Carry On films?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so So basically, there are a series of comedy films that are
based a lot in kind of innuendo and some weird gender stuff. There's a lot of like, you know, groping of women, and there's a lot of like silly daftness and all that sort of thing.
It's Benny Hill type comedy, is what
yes,
it is.
Yeah, it's in the vein of Benny Hill, but with a big kind of ensemble cast who then every film get into different roles and, you know, do all that sort of thing. So in the same way that we look back on it now and we're kind of like, that wasn't great, but we haven't erased them because you need to kind of at least go, okay, so that's what it used to be like. That's how men thought it was okay to treat women, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, or what was widely acceptable at the time. I think it's the same thing here, but I still, when I was watching it, I was just a bit uncomfortable. You know, and it doesn't detract from the film for me. I still really enjoy this film. I think it's such a brilliant, very sparse but kind of elegant thriller, because it's, you know, it doesn't have a lot of extra plot going on. It doesn't have a lot of fat on it. It's not very overblown in the way that, unfortunately, a lot of modern thrillers are. It's just, you know, a guy has been wronged. He kidnaps, you know, the daughter of the police chief, and he has to fight to prove his innocence. You know, and it works so well, and it's just this template that Hitchcock would then go on to, you know, use for decades to come.
Mm-hmm. Tom, before I get your impressions on the film, let's address the blackface aspect of the climax of the film here. What do you think about that?
It's very striking when you get to that ending of the film and you see this entire band in blackface. Yeah. And one, you know, and we're very honest on our show here that we're not experts on this controversial performance style, but in a way that I would summarize it is these were white musicians getting paid for being black musicians.
Yep.
Like, even the black musicians weren't allowed to have this money because the white musicians were making the money. And it's just, and like Chris was explaining, it's a mimicking of black people in a,
yeah,
turning them, their characteristics into clowning, into a clown face. And, you know, it's a very disrespectful style of performance. And but it does allow the drummer, who is eventually revealed as the murderer, it does allow the drummer to be disguised and then to be revealed. Mm-hmm. And, like, they wipe off in a horrible, you know, one minute he's covered in makeup and the next minute his face is clean, like a horribly, you know, poorly done edit. But they reveal who it is. Like, it's, oh, that's who, yeah, it is. You know, like, he's hiding. He's hiding. The drum kit is hidden in the band and he's trying to be disguised. And he also is revealed through his medical issue with the nervous twitch, the tick that he has. And it's a very compelling scene where, you know, he knows he has to take his medication to calm himself, but he's so nervous and he's going to get revealed and caught that he
ODs.
That if he's got a nervous tick to begin with, now he's really going to show it, right? Like, that's how he gets caught. So it's a very compelling scene in that regard. But yeah, the blackface thing is like, whoa, did they really do that? It's quite quite something to wrap your head around.
Yeah, and like I said, it works for me because it's a way to hide him in plain sight, you know, because she doesn't know what he looks like, and this guy, they're trying to find him based on the opinion of this homeless man, based on the memory of this homeless man. So hiding him in plain sight, let's cover his face up, and then so it's using history to hide him. So it worked for me in the film. So but Tom, so let's go for your impressions of the film overall. What do you think of Young and Innocent?
I enjoyed it, and I think the beginning was quite fresh and fun, and you know, they're out having a good time on the beach. Like, that was quite a great, you know, opening scene. And the wrong man accused theme, which becomes very popular with Hitchcock. It was an easy plot to follow for the viewer. And I think the woman that was the, you know, the accomplice, the constable's daughter, was a lot of fun. She was a real tomboy. She was really mechanically minded and very, that's a great dilemma. Like, you know, her dad's the police, and she's trying to avoid the police. You know, that was a lot of fun. It's almost like a Smokey and the Bandit thing, you know? And, no, I enjoyed it. It was refreshing. It was, there's a lot of comedic elements. One of the pieces I read preparing for the show refers to the ineptitude of the police as the keystone cops, you know? And, I've always, there are Hitchcock films which are comedies, which I enjoy. Like, The Trouble with Harry is considered to be a comedy, right? And I enjoy that element, even though he doesn't do it a lot. It was a nice change, a nice refreshing film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, for me, I really like the movie. And, you know, I talk about Star Trek Discovery a lot because of, you know, my Star Trek podcast and Star Trek stuff that I do. And we've got a thing going on right now where that's being kind of divisive right now because some of the writing in it, like, I won't get into it, but something happened in the last episode that seems to really divide people. Like, somebody died in the last episode, and I'm on the side that they didn't earn it because they haven't really developed this character prior to this. And then in this episode, they just dump everything that you need to know. So I'm critical of the writing. And I'm like, this movie, I'm watching it, and I'm like shaking my fist and screaming at the TV because of the ineptitude of this court. You know, and I'm like, it's all there to drive the plot. And it's like, this lawyer's ridiculous. These cops are ridiculous. And the law doesn't work like this. And they're like, this belt is such ridiculous circumstantial evidence, right? Where they're like, oh, look at this belt. And he's like, well, I have a coat too. Well, you must have done it then because you have a coat. You know, like, you know, it turns out to be that it actually was his coat. But I mean, like, I don't know, like, there's so much in, like, that's so circumstantial. Any lawyer, like, that got his degree out of a cereal box could get that, you know, guy off, you know?
What about the other 30 men in that town that own that same coat? Yeah, because only one coat store in town.
If
the belt fits, you acquit.
Wear it. I could get past that. Like, I don't not enjoy the movie. Like, I'll tell you later when we give our ratings. Like, I gave it a very good rating because it's good. And there's a lot of great stuff in this movie. But it's just that ineptitude of the cops and that ineptitude of the legal system, like, just drives me up the wall because it's so wrong. Like, that's not how it works. But I don't know. So, again, I did really enjoy the movie quite a fair amount. So that's my initial impression. But, you know, like, some of the comedy worked really well, like watching it with Aubrey, like during the bar scene, like the fight when she's asking about the coat. And then when the guy starts walking down the road and the guys are still fighting in the bottom corner, like Aubrey was laughing at the TV. They're like, ah, she's just still fighting in the corner there. And so, you know, some of the humor
worked. That bar fight was corny.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was so awkward.
Watching this movie,
it didn't look natural at all.
I know. It didn't understand why the friends didn't want him to talk about the China fixer. I'm like they're talking about it like there's some cover up, and it just, I don't know. So even that scene there didn't work for me. Even on a first viewing, like, I haven't seen this movie in forever. I know I've seen it, but I haven't seen it forever. So I didn't remember what was going on. I'm like, why are these people upset that they're talking about him? It doesn't make sense.
It's one of those bars where every day at 7 p.m. there's a big brawl, you know?
Yes, like, I don't know.
It's just that roughneck, redneck, rude kind of bar that, hey, let's have a fight, you know, whatever. Yeah. And the bartender has to buy new furniture every day.
Yeah.
That's why there's a China fixer, because the China's always getting broken in the bar brawls. Mm.
And that was a wonderful reveal when he goes to the homeless shelter and I thought you knew him. Can't you find him and see if he's here? And when he falls asleep and the bed's empty and he wakes up and the bed had been slept in, like, there's some really great Hitchcock stuff in this movie. But I got to ask, did you guys realize that when they came into the town and the man and the woman parked their car and there was like that overhead camera going through the town and whatnot, did you catch that was all miniature?
Nope.
And when they were like zooming in on the car, it was like a toy man, a toy woman, and a toy car. And then there's like a fade to like the live action of them.
I didn't catch that. You have a very keen eye.
It's very well done.
Yes, it is. So if you didn't catch it, that's good. So
that'll be my 5-minute rewatch. I'm going to go find that scene and watch that scene.
Yeah. Right at that transition. So, I mean, I don't know that I have a lot to say on this film because it is very similar to the 39 Steps, you know, and we've kind of talked about the climax of the film already. I mean, I guess we could talk about, you know, the long take, which I was reading up in one of my books here. So the complete films, Alfred Hitchcock, the complete films by Paul Duncan, you know, one of the photos here, one of the pages of photos, it's got, you know, the production sketch for the ballroom. Right. And then they've got this, they've got an image here that shows the long camera and how it turns and moves and whatnot. And they say in here that it took 2 days of rehearsals before the 145-foot shot was perfected. The camera operator had to constantly refocus as the camera moved, eventually stopping just 4 inches from the drummer's face. You know, so wow. 2 days of rehearsals to get that shot. And
yeah.
See, that's a technical thing that has always bothered me about film production. And like, I've been on film sets before, like where they're, you know, using film, big film cameras, but I've never been the film operator, the camera operator, or like in the camera department. But that thing where, like, we've all used video cameras, right? Mm-hmm. You can see the video that you're shooting and you can see if it's in focus or not. But these film cameras, especially back then, the image that the camera operator is seeing is basically a telescope down the side of the camera, and it's not the true image that's on the film. Yeah. So they have no way to focus. They have no optical reference to whether or not the film is in focus. They're doing the focus based on inches or feet from the subject. So there's a guy called the focus puller, and he or she, you know, that operator is running the focus wheel on the lens in increments, right? So to pull off that shot that you were just talking about, and to do it well, and to do it with the limited equipment of the day, is quite impressive.
Yeah, and this is something that we were talking about with Manish, right, in the last episode, where, you know, there's always that one shot, in it seems like in Hitchcock films, that's that really outstanding shot, and this is the one in this one here.
Mm-hmm. Better than the little toy men next to the little toy car?
Yes, that, although that was a very impressive miniature shot. I loved it.
I'm just thinking, I mean, I'll be honest, it's been about a week since I saw it, and it's sort of refreshed my brain, but I just, I just found it really interesting, and I just thought, you know, I do think it's funny, kind of pointing out, just like, that's not how a cart works, and it's, I kind of just glossed over it, because I'm like, yeah, that's not how a cart works. It's not how it works at all. But it does kind of just fit in that, this kind of heightened world that Hitchcock seems to live in, and it's something that you see in, you know, like Frenzy, where it just sort of goes, right, well, here's some circumstantial evidence, so clearly you're guilty, and we're gonna, you know, gonna throw the book at you and all that sort of thing. Which I think does come back to that old story of how his dad basically scarred him for life and threw him in a police cell, and that's what happens to naughty boys and all that sort of thing. Yeah. And his dad was clearly like a great, great person. I mean, I'm sure it worked in terms of like, hey, you're not going to misbehave, are you? It's like, nope, I'm going to have a lifelong obsession, though, with people who are wrongfully accused.
So it's just going to scar me for the rest of my life, that's all.
So, hey, Chris, in the real world, do you believe that story of Hitchcock as a child being put in the jail cell, or do you think that was part of his marketing hype, that a legend that he invented?
I don't...
Hitchcock wouldn't lie.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, when I first started watching Hitchcock, I was like, oh my God, that poor man. And then when I started learning about him, and I was like, maybe you deserved it, and he's just like, no, he was like a child. I don't know. Like most things with Hitchcock, I think there's probably an element of truth in it, and probably a bit of exaggeration, but I couldn't tell you to what degree.
I've thought of, like, we're around 30 episodes right now in our show. We talked about that really early in the first couple, like we're doing his biography and that whole childhood thing of his.
Yep.
And I've thought about that a lot, and I'm pretty confident that as a boy, he thought that up. Like, as a preteen, when he was starting to be, like, a creative writer type, he'd think, oh, wouldn't that be something if Daddy took me to the jail cell? And I'm scared. Like, I don't think it physically happened, but I think he's like, yeah, this is a great story. So when he started doing marketing and PR and press, that he just kept telling it and telling it. And I'm pretty confident that he fabricated that story. But it's still a good legend.
Yeah,
right?
It's still a great legend. But then it also opens a can of worms into, like, so he invented this whole thing, which means that basically since he was a child, he's had an obsession with people who were wrongly convicted. Because it's come from somewhere, because he hasn't come out of the womb being like, you know, mother, what if one day I'm in prison for a crime I did not commit? Like, that didn't happen. It's coming somewhere. So that's where I'm thinking, you know, I agree with, you know, Tom in that it could be that he's invented this, or it's kind of come out of imagination. But where's that come from? Because, you know, it's that whole thing about, like, nothing's original. It's like, yeah, okay, fair enough. But, you know, where is that piece from? Where is that interest in? Because you do see it really in, you know, Young Innocent. It is basically, you know, 39 Steps was adapted from, you know, Buchanan, and this was adapted from the book whose name I can't remember, even though you said it only about 20 minutes ago.
Oh, I closed my notes already, too. Here, let me see if I can open up. Fay or Say or something like that. It's Tina Fay or something.
Tay.
Like that.
Yeah. The early works of
yes.
Tina Fey.
Yeah. The early works of Tina Fey. Before Mean Girls, there was, you know, Slightly Mean Minstrel Man.
Before 30 yeah. Rock.
Anyway.
Tay,
yes.
Yeah, Josephine Tay.
Yeah. Joe Tay. But no, you know, and you do see this distillation and everything, so maybe this is kind of where, you know, this recurring thing started to happen more. Because once is like, oh cool, here's, you know, a one-off story. Two is a coincidence, and then three is a pattern, and so on and so forth. So it is, you know, I've said, you know, probably to an annoying amount of times, the one thing I do love kind of pulling from these early Hitchcock works is where these kind of themes that emerge come from. You know, where does the theme of here is the innocent man wrongly convicted, and how natural justice is going to restore that, you know? And maybe it's an indictment on the justice system, you know? Because you see that even in terms of Dial M for Murder, which is one that I came to a bit later and I really enjoy, and which to this day, I still, if I haven't seen it for a while, I don't get the ending. I don't get, you know, the intricacies of, like, oh, how is this actually solved, until I have to sit down and watch the film and work it out. But that is a bit of an indictment against, you know, not so much the police, but rather the law and order system, you know. And we see that again here. We see it in Frenzy. We see it, you know, across the board, really, in the, oh, well, they're incompetent. They've punished the wrong guy. So there's that. There's the stuff with, I mean, I would say the gender roles, but to be honest, Erica comes across really well here, you know, along with I cannot remember her name. She is the lead in The Man Who Knew Too Much. She is the wife. She's Nova Pilbeam's mum, in that she's the sharpshooter. I don't remember the actress's name. But those two are really great, interesting, you know, lead heroines. You've got, you know, a couple more sprinkled in, but then sort of towards, like, the most famous kind of 50s period is when you start to see these weird things of murder with Hitchcock. You know, you start to see, you know, even in Rear Window, which is one of my favourite ones, you get to see this weird kind of disdain he has for women, or this weird kind of relationship he has with them.
The young women that were the friends of the, or the young women that came across the body on the beach and witnessed him running away, they were interesting characters, too. Mm. And I definitely don't think of, you know, people hanging out on the beach when I think of Hitchcock. So that was a kind of a something unusual from his films. Mm-hmm.
Well, I enjoyed the movie. I don't have much to talk about, though. Like, I don't think it's as you know, an in-depth of yeah. film as some of the other ones. Like, it's a good movie. It reminds me a lot of 39 Steps, but I don't have much to deep dive into it, I'm afraid to say. I enjoyed it a lot, well, yeah, but
yeah,
I don't know. Did you guys have any final thoughts that you wanted to add on the film?
I have a question.
Sure.
Okay, so, the title is Young and Innocent. So, because everything's being remade in Hollywood, who would you cast as the lead to now? If they were going to do a remake, who would you do as the two leads? Because you've got Nova Pilbeam's character and then Derek DeMane, his character.
Okay. Well, I would probably... I'm not good with actors, but with their names, but what's Arya Stark from...
Maisie Williams.
Game of Thrones. Maisie Williams? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, probably put her in the main role.
That'd be cool, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and then maybe the kid from Walking Dead, Rick Grimes' son, for the...
Chandler Riggs? That's it. Yes.
Yeah,
okay, that's
like
cool.
That. Tom?
Tatiana Maslany?
Yes!
And Kim Coates.
I mean...
Kim Coates from Sons of Anarchy. And I'm being selfish because those are...
those are pretty old. There's not too young there.
Those are both actors from Saskatchewan. So that's my patriotic duty.
I will say... It's a running joke now how much I love Tatiana Maslany. And then it was like, oh, there's going to be another show. And it's, you know, and Tatiana Maslany's doing this now. And every so often, Tom will just send me links going, have you seen this? And I'm like, no, Tom, I haven't. But thank you, I do appreciate it. I'm trying to think who I'd cast.
Tom Caldwell, your source for Tatiana Maslany news.
Yeah.
You know, he secretly got like a Tumblr or something where it's just... She was spotted out buying a coffee.
I was gonna get a photograph and just like write her name in marker and send it to Chris and tell him it was an autograph. But that would have been cruel. That would have been mean.
I mean, I would have gone, what? No. Okay.
She's got awfully manly handwriting.
Yeah. Do you know who I would like to see do the two lead roles? And it's only because I'm getting I'm kind of following off Brandon's thing. I'm very excited for Game of Thrones because we're about a month away, and I've watched that one trailer about 20 times and watched all the breakdowns of it, and I'm stoked. But I would like if it's going to be in the UK and everything, I would be interested in seeing the actors who play Grey Worm and Missandei do it, because I've seen them both in other things, and I'm like, oh, okay, that'd be cool. Or maybe like Sophie Turner. You went with Arya. I like Sansa. So,
so Game of Thrones and Innocent is what.
Basically young and innocent and most likely dead. Oh.
How would the murder have gone down, or how would the death have happened at the beginning if it was a Game of Thrones theme?
It was really the mountain, and he crushed her head.
Oh my! That'd be even funnier, because if you get someone like. Nowhere near as powerful. You're just like, well, clearly he crushed her head, and he just got someone really skinny who's like, how? How did
we saw you running away.
Just like, you don't know your own strength. And it's like, what? Like, no, of course I did. No, yeah.
Every single supporting character would get killed immediately after they deliver one line. It would just be like, slash, kill. Anyway.
Either that or the ball... Oh, the ballroom scene at the end is just literally every single actor who died on the show, and you just move through, and it's just like going, oh, they're dead. Oh, they're dead, yeah.
Hey, I'm pretty sure we hit a tangent.
I know. It's my fault.
I think we're running out of content here.
I know.
Excellent. Well, why don't we wrap it up with our ratings and whatnot. Chris, do you want to, or Tom, actually, let's start with you. Give us your rating on the film.
Oh, we have to have a clever measurement. I will give it 4 reasons not to hang out on a beach with high cliffs.
Nice. Chris?
I will give it 4.5 twitches that definitely aren't sinister at all.
you almost took my rating. I gave it 4 out of 5 facial ticks.
Okay, so. You're on video camera on the camera chat. Show us one of them. What does one of them look like? Yeah, there you go. That'll be in the extended DVD version of this podcast.
Oh, Jesus.
Excellent, right on. Well, Tom, where can people find you when you're not playing the drums?
When I'm not drumming in a band that doesn't appreciate my rhythm, I hang out on Twitter as Tom Caldwell 3000.
We don't appreciate your rhythm because you're stoned, Tom, and you're not doing the rhythm. You took too much medicine.
Those are prescription medications. And anyway, he's only the drummer. And Instagram, @TomCaldwell. Avoid all the imitators. And as I like to say, we do appreciate every time anybody gets on our Facebook and our Twitter and says hello and gives us ideas or complaints or comments. And I forget his name right now, but one of our listeners recently recommended the Spanish program on Netflix, where in the episode of the show, they are investigating a potential kidnapping of Alfred Hitchcock at a premiere. And if you get on our Facebook, you'll find that link. And that was a very interesting episode to watch. And but again, awesome viewer participation. We really appreciate it anytime people give us input.
Yeah.
Yes, excellent. Thanks so much. Chris, where can people find you when you're not falling in love with people who are being accused of murder, who are wrongly convicted? I just messed that all up. Blah, 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 blah.
It's fine. When I'm not busy falling in love with people in prison or who I think are secretly innocent, which happens a shocking amount, you could find me on Twitter at @Hire_boy. Like Tom said, thank you so much for anyone who is giving us, you know, is listening, is, you know, give us a little shout out, sending us messages, sending us suggestions. It's all great. I am a co-host of another podcast, North by Nerd West. We've taken a bit of a hiatus just while we kind of get our ducks in a row, but we are hoping to get some new episodes out this summer. Apart from that, I also appear on a bunch of other podcasts, such as Eccentric Earth with my mate Amy Walker, who does unusual snapshots of history in which the guest doesn't know what they're going to be talking about before the episode starts, which is great. And then stuff like Smorgasbord with Pete Gaskell, and I've recently done a Pick a Disc with Matt Latham as well. So yeah, just feel free to check those out and follow me on Twitter if you fancy just seeing how much I will retweet on a day and my usual ramblings about pretty much anything and everything.
Excellent. And I looked it up while you were talking there. So loyal listener Lori Damon Bowes, I hope I'm saying your name right, pointed us to it. So it's The Ministry of Time is the show, Spanish show with subtitles, season 3, episode 1.
Yeah.
And the episode's called With Time on His Heels.
That was a cruel show to watch. I really enjoyed that.
I'm going to say I started watching it last year and I forgot to catch up, but yeah, it's very cool.
Mm-hmm. And you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me on Trek FM with Melodic Treks, which has had a couple of new episodes, which we talk about the music of Star Trek. I'm also on Warp 5 with my friend Patrick. And you can find me on the Cinematic Sound Radio Network every once in a while with episodes of Breaking the Waves. And as of the recording of this, part one of my interview with Jason Cullimore, who composed our theme, has been released. It's a very interesting discussion with him that we conducted here in my basement over Christmas. So be sure to check that out in the Cinematic Sound Master feed to get a little bit more knowledge on Jason. And we thank very much Jason Cullimore for creating our awesome theme music. You can find him at jasoncullimore.com. We'd like to thank the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show in their feeds. Be sure to check out the feed because they got lots of great great shows on their feed. And don't forget to check out Annie and Catherine and their show, Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. They're on a little bit of a hiatus right now. I hope everything is going good for them. They're taking a bit of time off right now. They've also dropped their episodes to every other week, but they're still doing great stuff. So be sure to check it out. With their show and our show combined, you get a near comprehensive look at everything Hitchcock related. And I guess that's it for us. Well, you can find us on Twitter at Good Evening Pod, and then click rate and review. Give us some reviews. Help us out.
There's a bit of a surprise coming up. We won't give too much information, but there's potential for Pat McFadden to be stepping into an episode coming up. Our man who knows exactly enough.
Yes,
our associate producer. He's very supportive of our show. We really appreciate all the help he gives us behind the scenes.
Excellent. And next episode, we got tentatively, it's booked. Everything should go through. We got ourselves an awesome, really cool special guest for The Lady Vanishes. So be sure to check that out next time. So watch ahead. Watch The Lady Vanishes. But until next time, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.